start out with 24:19, and you want to tell us what it's about? Okay, we're going to look at the first question on 24:19.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 24:19 exempts surface mining activities from local land use determination of interruption or abandonment, provided that the operator has a permit or an exemption is annually received, and provided that the mine is not inactive for 12 years or more. It also specifies that the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries authority shall be valid, subject to certain conditions, until operation is completed or mining operations cease and the site is reclaimed. The bill also changes the condition of failing to complete reclamation from within 3 years to within a timely manner, or if the committee fails to maintain an operating permit and pay all required fees. The bill has an emergency clause, making it effective upon passage because of pending litigation. The bill also establishes, once again, state policy that surface mining non-conforming uses are not determined, interrupted, or abandoned if inactive for 12 years or less when the owner has maintained a state or local surface mining permit or exemption. We heard testimony, extensive testimony, in a hearing on the 27th.
Okay, any questions? Okay, we do have a request for somebody that wanted to testify that couldn't testify. I don't know if you want to take an additional testimony or not. I don't know if you change anybody's mind on the question.
Is this somebody to testify?
Well, I'm telling you, here, let me testify.
Sure.
Can we give him a few minutes? Can we do it in about 3 minutes?
Chair Durfler, members of the committee and committee staff, we greatly appreciate the opportunity to address you for just a few moments here to address the subject of our lawsuit, the sessions of the lawsuits that would be referred by this bill. We'd like to can divide our testimony into two sessions, so I'm going to let my better half go first. For the record, my name is Stephen Sanders. I'm live at 2190 Crest Drive in Lake Oswego.
My name is Jamie Sanders. I also live at 2190 Crest Drive, Lake Oswego. Thank you for this opportunity. I was struck last week by how reasonable bills seem when you only hear one side of them. As Mr. Whitman of the Department of Justice said, 2419 actually addresses two very separate topics. You mostly heard testimony in opposition to the land use part of that bill last week. We are the Sanders, to the Sanders case that Mr. Rybernik referred to. The second half of 2419 is intended to overturn the result of that case. I handed in a copy of the judgment and opinion in that case. You may have gotten the impression from the testimony last week that present mined land reclamation law, like present land use law, is perceived as not flexible enough for the cyclical nature of the quarry industry. That is not true. As Mr. Whitman's letter from the Department of Justice states, under present mined land reclamation law, an operator will not be required to close and reclaim a quarry no matter how long the period of disuse, if they had given notice to the Ogami, either by an operating plan or by other written notice. Mr. Towne testified in favor of 2419 last week. He is the president and owner of the quarry company whose quarry is affected by the Sanders versus Ogami case. Mr. Rybernik is the land use attorney for that company. The facts there were that the operator did not have an operating plan or a permit at the time that they were required to. They did not give accurate notice to Ogami of their activities. if the Court of Appeals sustains the circuit court and holds that that particular site has to be reclaimed, that will be the reason, not because they ceased activity for a year. Thank you very much.
I'd like to point out that there are two broad themes, aside from reversing our case, but perhaps more fundamentally important for the committee, that this bill would do. First of all, it gives illegal quarry operators a complete pass on reclamation, because now the reclamation obligation is tied merely to whether the person conducted surface mining and then stopped. Under the definition and interpretation that the bill would be given, only those people with an operating permit will be required to reclaim. So those persons and operators who were required to have a reclamation plan and operating permit but did not would never become subject to the reclamation standards as we understand the Department of Justice's interpretation. Thus, the competitive advantage is granted to those companies who operate illegally outside their exempt area and do not notify the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries that they've done so. You are creating a huge incentive to operate illegally. The second point is that it prevents private persons or any third persons from suing or bringing any activity or action to force reclamation or any other standards within the law. As it is now, the reclamation of abandoned quarry sites is mandatory. Under the bill as it would be proposed, the reclamation would be at the discretion of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and then only after quarrying was completed. When quarrying would be completely at the discretion of the operator. So long as they paid their annual permits, reclamation could be avoided indefinitely. We think the net effect then would be both to shift the burden of quarrying damage to the public, and second, to prevent the public from having an opportunity to insist on repair of that damage. We are not asking that quarrying be stopped. We are not opposed to quarrying or mining activity. We are merely asking that the effects of quarrying be balanced against the effects that it does to the private property interests of others like us who live nearby, and for others like us who represent the public interest, as the court said we did in our case. We thank the committee for the time to present this.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it very much. Okay, we are going to item this bill. And if you have an amendment, we have the A8, I think. And do you have others?
Yeah.
Okay, there was.
Yes.
One thing is I'd like to make a statement on this bill. These bills are very, very difficult for legislators to make decisions on. And I would say that the reason that this bill is before us primarily is because of the very, very poor attitude that the company had in Stafford. They didn't do a good job of being a good neighbor. And primarily, this problem came about because of that poor practice. And I would hope that that would be rectified in the future. And these people that are going to do business in these areas should really be good neighbors, in my opinion. So just that kind of a statement. Okay.
Mr. Chair. I was going to ask if somebody could explain the Dash 8.
Yeah, the Dash 8, I think what it does is it allows the inactivity to go on for 12 years. And if there's not activity after the 12 years, then the employee is considered to be a bad.
As opposed to the bill which lets it go on.
And this current law has a definition of abandonment of surface mining. This would replace that definition.
There's a section of the law, I mean, in a bill, and it's new language on page 2, that this is amending. I was just trying to get a feel for how it changed the bill.
Yes, you are welcome, Robert.
Good afternoon. My name is Rich Angstrom. I'm the Managing Director for the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. The A8 amendment was an amendment worked out with Dogami, ODOT, the governor's staff, myself, and a couple of private attorneys. What was of concern was the present bill that came over from the House did not have a time limitation on it. And so what a person could do and what the worry was that a person just could continue to indefinitely renew their permits and avoid any, you know, any kind of obligation at all for doing anything. And so the request was from folks to have a limitation on that. And there was some discussion of whether it should be 10, 12, or 15 years because there's a period of time in that 1980s period there where there was a recession. And the 12 years was selected to in basically to encompass the recessionary period of the 80s. So this really is a limitation on the bill that was initially offered by OCAP.
How long was Tiger, Sand, and Gravel inactive?
I think there's a dispute on that. I think if you ask the company, they'd say a couple of years, like two or so. And I think the Neighborhood Association would say seven. Or eight, okay. Seven or eight.
Less than
12.
I have another question.
Great.
I noticed that you said this was you worked this out with working with the governor. Is it your expectation that the governor would sign this bill with the dash 8?
My expectation is the governor will see this as a good policy and sign the bill.
Okay. Any other discussion? Okay. Chair would entertain a motion.
I move the dash 8.
Okay, any objections to the dash 8? Hearing none, what's the dash 8?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the dash A9.
Do we need the dash A9? Okay.
Do we have them?
Mm-hmm. So move to.
Gave them to us the last.
Okay. Well, that's the one that we're at.
Okay.
Remove Tiger
Sand. Tiger. Another problem I have with that, from a personal standpoint, I have a few other people. I have people from Amity that want to close theirs down, and I have another one from Turner that would be interested in training, getting that shut down. And if you're going to make an exception for one, then that shouldn't be for everyone.
The difference I see with this one, Mr. Chair, is it's through local practice.
Mm-hmm.
Local governments have rules. There was plenty of opportunity for input, and they used their local regulations to make that information, and I think the state as well. But
okay. It's difficult when you start moving one.
I understand, but I see the distinction as being that this one went through a local process, and there's no reason to believe that process was flawed that I know of, and went through the process. I think they deserve to.
Can we have a roll call vote on dash 9?
Senator Starr?
No.
Senator Cannon?
No.
Senator Dick?
Aye.
Senator Dutton?
No. Motion failed.
Okay. House Bill 2419 is amended as far as the due pass recommendation.
Okay, any discussion? Not, could we have a roll call vote first?
Senator
Starr.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Dick.
No.
Senator Becker.
Aye. Yes. And I'll wait and see what I guess. Okay, I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 3607. And you want to give us a little bit of a review of what 3607 did?
House Bill 3607 modifies the limit of the wages that employers must pay, penalty wages, if they fail to pay final wages when due. It imposes a civil penalty for failure to pay such penalty wages, or failure to pay minimum wage or overtime. It reduces but does not eliminate civil penalties. We heard testimony on the amount of underpayment and then the amount of related penalties. And currently, if an employer doesn't pay final wages, in addition to paying the final wages as a penalty, as the makeup, then they also have to pay penalty wages, which would be 30 full 8-hour days. House Bill 3607 limits that penalty to the lesser of final wages due or 30 days of wages, in addition to paying the final wages due. And this calculation, they say, is consistent with the Fair Labor Standards Act. There were no amendments offered.
Okay. Any discussion on 3607? You are in a work session.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
I don't know that it's worthwhile going through the whole process. I'm not going to support the bill with the language in it online. I don't intend that those who receive 100% of the unpaid wages as compensation and said were less. I could make that amendment, but I sort of suspect that it would be a waste of time to do that.
Okay. Chair, okay. Ask for a motion to
move House Bill 3607 to the floor of the best recommendation.
Okay. Any discussion? If not, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Aye.
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 No.
Hi. Okay. You found it?
Yeah.
Okay. Any volunteers want to carry it back? Or you? Oh, okay. Okay, we're going to open up a public hearing at 1180. Okay, we're Chris Dudley and Ron Wilson wants to come up and go through the bill for us and tell us what it does and why we need it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Dudley. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon School Boards Association, 1201 Court Street Northeast in Salem. On my left is Ron Wilson, our Director of Labor Relations. Who has been working with us on some of these personnel issues this year. And before you is Senate Bill 1180 and I believe the -4 amendments are what we're talking about today. We call this Senate Bill 1180 light. It was quite a bit heavier bill before, but a lot of stuff's been taken out of it, and it's down to basically about 5 major issues revolving around the teacher contract law as you changed it in 1997. So -4 amendments make a couple of changes to the statute we think are needed for clarification and a couple of substantive issues that are a little deeper than that. First of all, the teacher contract date changes. In 1997, you moved back in the year the date at which the deadline was for letting individuals know, probationary teachers, if they were going to be non-renewed, I believe, contract teachers if they're going to be extended. And that took 2 weeks of program time in terms of evaluation out of the system for us as administrators of the system. So Senate Bill 1180-4 would move that back to April 1 date that it was prior to 1997 and had been for a number of years. The second issue is programs of assistance for improvement and their clarification is in sections 2 and 3 of the -4 amendments. Basically what this says is there's some clarification language where it says, quote, school district means a common and union high school district, and then where it's taken the word share dismissal out and put school district or education service district in, that's simply to reflect the fact we don't have fair dismissal districts anymore under the change in statutes made in 97, but they are school districts that contracted teachers. That's simply a clarification or uniformity change. Then it clarifies that a program of assistance for improvement is for contract teachers. These changes clarify the fact that programs of assistance for improvement, a complex and lengthy procedure, is not required for the probationary teachers. Probationary periods need to be flexible, allowing a greater amount of discretion for supervisors.
Was there instances where we had probationary teachers that were put on some of the questions?
You may be, and as a matter of fact, you identified a deficiency on a probationary teacher, and you may well want to identify a program of assistance for that individual. The difference is that the statute requires you to non-renew a probationary teacher for any reason deemed a good faith sufficient. That's the lower test for probationary individuals. So what we're going to clarify here, we're trying to clarify here, is you're not required to go through and complete that program of assistance for improvement for a probationary teacher. You can not renew or dismiss without taking that step.
Yes. Ron Wilson, Director of Labor Relations. We believe that there should be a difference in the types of procedural protections that a contract teacher has and a probationary teacher has. If we also go back to the wording of the statute that was passed in 1997, it talks about a program of assistance for improvement for a contract teacher. But as it goes on in terms of describing what that entails, it just uses the word teacher. So we think that the original intent was always to have a program of assistance for improvement for a probationary, for a contract teacher, but not probationary teachers, so that there's a lesser amount of procedure and process that's required by statute. In other words, it is a true probationary period.
Okay. Does this probationary teacher have a contract?
Probationary teacher does not have a contract in the same sense that the new contract teachers do. All teachers have an individual document that we sometimes also call a contract, so we use the same terminology, but it gets very confusing.
Are you meaning tenure?
No.
Well?
A probationary teacher does not no longer has tenure, neither do our former permanent teachers have tenure. Senate Bill 1897 changed that. There's a 3-year probationary period, and then they achieve contract status. And the contract status has the same protections that the former permanent status had.
Okay.
So what we're trying to do with these amendments is clarify that while you're a probationary teacher, even if you have an individual contract for that year, the test for non-renewing that contract as a probationary teacher does not include completion of the process of a program of improvement, since it can still be the standard that it always was in the past, which was any reason deemed in good faith sufficient by the board. So that's what we're trying to do, is make sure it's clarified that that hasn't been inhibited by the way we changed the language in 1997.
Maybe my memory is really bad, but I thought before the idea was you take a new teacher and you monitor them, and if there are problems, you put them on a program of assistance and you work with them. And is what you're saying now that in lieu of that, you would just be able to let them go?
The process that you're describing is the process that has been identified in the statute for a contract teacher. Now, that the contract teacher may be new to a particular district, but they still have to serve a 3-year probationary period. During that 3-year probationary period, the district may elect to have a program of assistance for a particular deficiency, or it may elect not to. So what we're requesting is that it be clarified that it is indeed a choice of the district to be able to do this, to be able to have a program of assistance or not, rather than to have the statute require that in all cases a program of assistance for improvement would be required.
And now I was not involved in the interval discussions that went on with all this. I didn't remember ever hearing it described quite that way. You're asking for 3 years' worth of at-will employees.
That's the current statute on probationary teachers. Yes.
But they don't have to have a plan of assistance?
Correct.
So then what is the change?
If you look
something here, obviously.
If you look on page 2, of the bill. On line 27 and 28, mm-hmm. you'll see that a program of assistance for improvement is for a contract teacher.
That's current law.
That's current law. The change would add in line 29 that it's for contract teachers to bring that into line with the other parts of that definition that's on the top of page 3, where it says contract teacher in line 1 on top of page 3, and also contract teacher in line 3 on page top of page.
So you're suggesting that 2 years ago you never intended for a process to work with a probationary teacher during the first 3 years of their employment with the school district?
No, we never intended for a program of assistance to be required before you take, it to be completed before you take action on a probationary teacher. If the district chooses to start a program of assistance for improvement for a probationary teacher, they can do that. But what we did not want was to have this read as that's a condition proceeding for taking action for continuing employment for probation, even though it is a contract teacher and always was. We thought that's what the law said. Thought of what it always said, and we're trying to clarify in here that that's what it, in fact, does say.
Does that seem like a long period of time, 3 years, you could work for an employer and at any point in time go in and be told you're gone at the end of the day?
Well, it's not 3 years in the sense of 365 days. It's three
but it is
school
years.
Right. Actually, a three-year probationary period for school teachers, K-12 school teachers across the nation is not that unusual.
But in terms of other employment within Oregon, it just it struck me as a long period during which basically you're saying they don't have any rights.
No, it's not that they don't have any rights. They still have rights in the sense that they cannot be dismissed except for the school board having a reason and good faith decision. So that is a threshold. It's a low threshold, but it is a threshold. But that is what a probationary period entails. Now, if you compare teachers, say, to other non-professional workers, typical probationary period is about 6 months to a year. Classified employees in schools, again, their probationary period ranges anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half.
Mr. Chair, a three-year probationary period has been in effect here for 30 years, 25, 30 years. So this is not new.
Well, apparently not.
And the standard that we're asking for allowing us to non-renew is still the same standard that we currently have. We want to clarify. It's the same standard under which we've operated for the last 30 years. And if you look at one of the reasons that you provide that kind of flexibility the first 3 years is once you're a permanent teacher and now a contract teacher, it is not at all easy to take that action. As a matter of fact, less than 1% of the individuals that are serving as classroom teachers in this state that are permanent status are removed from that status. So
probably not because it's a difficult process, but because your administrators choose not to use the process as it exists.
I'm talking about 1% is all processes, not just for the dismissal.
I think most administrators have never taught how to use it.
Yeah. But that doesn't excuse changing the standard for probation at all. If you're going to have a strong contract status for teachers that pass that threshold, then you ought to have a very flexible process those first 3 years. That's what we've already said. We want to make sure it's read that way.
I think that Sean brings up a good point, though, that they also have a contract here, so we need to make sure on the record that a contract teacher is not, is a probationary teacher and a contract teacher. That's what I don't understand.
I have a question.
The situation is.
Okay, on in your amendment, on page 7, on line 4, it says, an assessment of the effectiveness of the teacher in producing individual student achievement growth. I need a little bit.
Why don't you wait till we get to that?
Oh, I was going through the bill?
Yeah, I'm still on page 3.
I just want to get to the meat.
Okay.
That thing's also okay, so I got there.
Mr. Chair, we'll try to get there quickly.
Okay.
Part-time and full-time teachers in Section 4. And this is simply a clarification statute, which I hope is more clear than the last clarification statute. And that is that right now, when you have 3 years of part-time service with a district and get renewed, the statute provides you to have contract status as a part-time teacher. We want the statute clarified that if you make a full-time assignment with that individual for a period of time, you don't automatically grant them that full-time status as a contract teacher, but we can use them flexibly until we actually offer it as a full-time individual. The issue here is if you have people not there or on sabbatical and you want to use these individuals in those spots, if you don't make this clarification, then you end up with too many individuals when people come back or get well, and then you're in a RIF or layoff situation inadvertently because you use the person who's been part-time in a full-time slot for a while. And I think that it's probably better for the staff to know this ahead of time, what their status is, and it's better for the school district to have that flexibility. And that's what the change in Section 4 on page 4 would accomplish. Then the April 1 date changes on page 5 are the same as I mentioned earlier. It's a uniformity change. Section 5, relating to teacher evaluation, there's a couple of changes in here. If you look at page 6, lines 11 through 14, you'll note that the purpose of evaluation is stated in the statute in a section that talks about each probationary teacher, line 10. We think that was misplaced, and this is simply a clarification to get it down into the section of law that talks about school district shall develop an evaluation process for teachers, and the same language is there now in consultation with administration with teachers, or if they have a bargaining rep, with a bargaining rep. Then move down into this section, the purpose of the evaluation process, because we think it's just a cleanup of the statute makes it better. Then the two VATs for the witches on the bottom of page 6, you assume will just clean up. Now we get to Senator Shannon's question. In this section of law, there's a description of what should be included in an evaluation process. And we're proposing a change by adding a subsection D that says an assessment of the effectiveness of the teacher in producing individual student achievement growth. It's our belief that one of the purposes, or a major purpose for an evaluation process, is to determine whether a teacher is effective in terms of teaching children. And I think with the talk about accountability in all kinds of ways, but the public school system, the way we spend money, what we spend, and the efforts to make sure that students get out of this system an adequate education, we're suggesting that one of the components of evaluation of a teacher, which includes administrators in this step, teachers administrators, is some measurement of their effectiveness in producing individual student achievement growth. The first,
who's going to do this evaluation?
It depends on the evaluation process that's developed in that school district, but it's inside that process that's required to be developed in that district. It's probably going to be a building-level administrator in most school districts. Some places might have a central office that does evaluations, but I don't think districts have that anymore.
It will be done probably by a principal of a school that observes the teacher.
It has to be a licensed individual, except in the very smallest districts, which sometimes will contract with the education service district to do their evaluations. But, it's going to be whatever the structure is in that particular district.
Right, but that evaluation by statute on the previous page requires that it be done at least with two observations and other relevant information. And most typically, a teacher would have that done by a licensed administrator. More than likely, the principal or perhaps the assistant principal. Administrators, in turn, would have that evaluation done by the superintendent.
Actually, that's primarily what an administrator does, is evaluate teachers every day. And that's their primary goal, is to make sure that kids are being taught properly and there's progress being made and so on.
Yeah, it's one of the things that we tell administrators and, in fact, all supervisors is that evaluation should be an ongoing process. It should be just something that you do once or twice each year.
An everyday process.
An everyday process. but that process, my statute, has to have a form and a structure and a process in and of itself. So as part of those minimum requirements, not only that it be based on job description, on performance standards, we're also requesting that it be based on an assessment of the effectiveness of the teacher in producing student achievement.
Do you want to come back to my comment, my concern? I mean, you want me to say it now?
Yeah.
I have great concern with this.
Yeah.
I'll share it with you.
Yeah.
And that is, in the words, in effectiveness of the teacher in producing individual student achievement growth. And that's undefined. And my concern is there are conservatives, friends of mine, that are very concerned about the education reform because of what happened in Kentucky. And I have it up in the book in my office, a newspaper reprint, for that the kids in one Kentucky high school consistently scored very high on SATs. Yet when the school reform, which Oregon, we think we created, but it's much like Kentucky's, when the new state test came in, these kids, because it was more about values and what they believed and thought and that, instead of what I don't hold sacred, but I hold very high national standard achievement tests. And I think that our kids and our teachers should be judged by how the children are doing on national standard achievement tests, because when they leave our schools in Oregon and when they fly from the nest, they will be competing against kids from Iowa, California, and all over. And I don't want a conscientious, wonderful teacher to lose her job or his job because they're not teaching to this new experiment called the Oregon 20th century, 21st century, whatever it is. I want the good, conscientious teachers that still believe in teaching our kids to compete with the world, not to keep the jobs, because they're the teachers I want to promote. And I have received many emails and many phone calls and much criticism by people that said the bill that you did last time was going to help get rid of the conscientious teachers because they're not going with the flow with the school reform. And I think that it behooves us, because I know the people sitting up here, and I know that lots of times we want to do the right thing, and we believe that the rhetoric we're using is reality, but it is not. And I think we should define what is student achievement growth. I came up for air, and I feel really strong, and I could never support this unless we define what is student achievement growth. I do not want to get a teacher fired because she has more care about these kids' actual academics than these legislators that have never been in a classroom in their life, but they're going to put these laws out for the teachers to follow. I mean, teaching in a classroom, maybe they visited.
I hear your pain, but I believe that this goes to a different standard than what you're assuming it does.
Then let's not assume. Let's define
it. How are you going to define it?
National.
As measured by?
Yes, the Iowa Achievement Test. Those kids score high in math and reading. Let's put it, tie it to a, because there's a lot of fifth grade teachers out there that they think you're trying to get them fired. They're scared. Nobody, and a lot of them don't want to teach fifth grade. And let's just do it to a national test, not one that we're developing and experimenting with in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, the reason we put the words we did in there was so it wouldn't be tied to any single state test. The concept here is that a teacher gets 25 or 30 kids that may have all different levels of achievement when they come in. And what we're after is some measurement of that teacher's ability to bring those children forward, not against any statewide test, not against the, we could have said that if that's what you want, if that's what one wanted, they could have talked about the benchmark test, which are not talked about. And it's specifically our purpose not to talk about them. That what you want here is an evaluation process that's developed in a community that meets that community's expectations in terms of how that school system is carried out, and that develops an evaluation process that allows a measurement of those pupils' individual growth in that teacher's classroom, not against a statewide or nationally known test, but in terms of each individual student's ability to grow. And that's going to be a bunch of different ways of assessment. For instance, this also applies to the principal. The principal is a teacher under this definition, will be under that evaluation, or an assistant principal. And so in the environment that they're working in that school system, we're asking for a criteria that says part of your evaluation is how well are kids doing under your supervision, the kids that you have. And it doesn't tie it to any particular test, and it didn't do that on purpose, so they could make those definitions local.
Well, if you're not going to then if you're not going to tie it to anything, then it's going to be just the definition of whoever's in the mind that wants to dump a teacher or a principal. And I honestly do think that we need to define our words.
So perhaps two points that you might want to consider. One is the way that the wording of this proposed amendment is now does not preclude the use of standardized tests, but it does really leave it up to the local school board and the local evaluation process. Secondly, if the concern is will there be a reasonable standard applied in relationship to this and what protections do teachers have, they have protections in the fair dismissal statute itself, that all of the stated reasons for dismissal, neglect of duty, insubordination, inefficiency, etc., all have to be played against another standard. That other standard is whether the expectations of the school board are reasonable. So there are protections for teachers within the fair dismissal statute that they can look at any action that might be taken by a district that is unreasonable in relationship to student achievement data. So there is another view and another forum that will be looked at. Now that fair dismissal process includes a three-person panel, a school board member, a teacher, and a member of the public.
Okay. In the 95 session, we did the score form, I think it was 2991. And in the conference committee, AOI insisted that we keep in there one of the goals of the education is that collaborative workers, because they want collaborative thinkers, collaborative, because they want compliant workers. What if you have a teacher that wants to teach like I would? I can do anything. My answers are my answers, right or wrong. I'll correct them. And you get a principal that says you're not doing enough to make collaborative thinkers out of these kids. And the law says you shall have a curriculum and implement it that makes these kids collaborative. That's why some of the fourth graders, they come home with wrong answers because their little group voted and that's the right math answer. And I'm not making this up. In this very room, I heard the people from Coos Bay telling us about it. What if the grandma went to school and said, why is this, my granddaughter doesn't want to change her answer? And she said, well, it's because they get just as much credit working with the group, becomes collaborative, whatever. And I just think that we need, and this is after 91, this is 95, we need to define what is achievement growth. Because they're good, the old-fashioned teachers that want these kids to grow up and trust in themselves, and, you know, we work with other people, but mostly on their own talents and knowledge. We need to know what that is, because I'm not making this up. I've received many emails that they're just trying to write laws here that will be used to weed out the old-fashioned teachers.
That's not our purpose.
Not your purpose.
That's not the reason this language is here. And I don't think school boards will do that.
Teachers aren't comfortable with it, though.
You can't help that. I mean, they weren't comfortable with 880, and they weren't comfortable with 750. And they drummed up a lot of opposition to some people that supported those bills, including recall of some of my board, but for the wrong reasons. The amount of protection that teachers have under your statutes that you passed is incredible. It is not. It did not threaten them. It did not allow us to willy-nilly fire people for having the wrong size earring holes. It didn't do any of that. And I don't believe it would do what you're worried about either. I think most communities are really interested in their kids achieving well, and the same thing you're interested in, which is being successful adults in a world that's changing, and that requires some change in the kinds of knowledge they have and skills they have. But the issue here is whether the evaluation process that we're going to apply to contract teachers in the state has a component of it that deals with whether children are learning. And if you want to say it that way, that's fine. But what we're after is some kind of a component in the evaluation process that says the person is effective in teaching.
I don't think
you should define it. I don't think you should statutorily define it as a given test, for instance, at the state level.
You don't think it should be reasonable, what reasonable people would think that children should, the knowledge they should gain that year or something?
Well, in terms of the standard on a school board for upholding the dismissal, it has to be reasonable. That's all I understand.
Because Vern Duncan often says there are years that he wishes he would for them to taught, you know, that, and we all do, salary would be based on how much the kids learned that year. And the next year you worked harder and the kids learned less. And if our teachers signed up to testify, I just think this would be a little bit of a concern. Are we only listening to these or what?
Well, we have a sign-up sheet, but we only have one of the Christian Arcadia who's over here.
Okay.
I do think that you have to have a measurement somehow, and I would venture to say that every principal in every school could go in and evaluate each teacher and tell you who are the outstanding teachers, who are the mediocre teachers, and who are the poor teachers. Because they observe these going down all the time. That's what their job is.
The teachers tell me there's a third of the teachers that want to teach what they know works. And they're really troubled by the reform. There's a third of the teachers that say, bring on more reform. I love it. This is great. I can really relate to these kids. And a third of them are just hanging on till retirement. And I just think that we should know what we're going to evaluate, what kind of achievement we're going to, what's the standard. I think somehow we should have input on that. I don't even have an answer, Senator Durfler, but I am concerned that...
Do you think that we ought to measure teachers? We shouldn't measure teachers? There should be some criteria of saying, this is good or that's better.
Well, you know what? I would even feel better if it said academic achievement growth. Because if the achievement is that I'm closer, I'm the best collaborative thinker in the room, I don't have an individual thought of my own, but I'm collaborative, then they've achieved that. I really should be asking academic achievement.
I guess I don't have a problem with that. Our other things are than academic and good.
But you know what? If they don't teach them how to read and that, I mean, we think good about ourselves and get along with everybody, but we're not going far in this world if we haven't caught success on any academics.
I would not have a problem if you don't put academic in there.
Okay, I do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you have a problem with that, Ron? Chris?
You want narrowing. I guess I'm asking a question. Is it your intention to narrow the field of what type of achievement growth that a teacher or administrator could be measured against? Okay. And then what does academic mean?
I have a little bit of a problem with that narrowing because I think teaching of citizenship and character and things that are necessary for productive citizenry might be defined out of this definition if we dispose of the academic. And I think that without the instilling of values and character, along with the academics, we fail to do the job of teaching.
Have you measured that they stole less this year than they did the year before?
Well, they really...
Huh? How do you measure character improvement?
It's
an improvement, right?
Yeah. You think back about the outstanding teachers, it wasn't the academics that you learned from the teacher, it was that I can be successful. That I ended this well, or that I can do something. Some of these kids that perhaps have not had the successes, a good teacher brings that success out of us.
But the whole thing, the whole thing that we're trying to do is move away from the fact because that now if the international scores show that our kids feel the best about themselves but score the lowest, and the Japanese kids feel the worst but score the highest, and I think it's important what you're saying, but I think we need to be in the, you know, the truth isn't clear over here, or yeah, it needs to be balanced. That's what I'm saying. And so, we need a balance, is what I am saying.
If you say you can't measure a teacher, to me it's incorrect. You shouldn't be able to measure a teacher by some of the growth that the students are learning.
Well, I didn't say it was incorrect. I just said I don't want all these teachers measured by how good they've adapted to the school reform because I'm not convinced that it's the best thing since sliced bread. That's all. I don't want that to be the standard.
You'd like to have an objective standard.
Mm-hmm. Something that's been proven and worked. I don't think we have to keep experimenting with our kids. Do you know any other states? I have a lot of confidence, and I know you communicate with other states. Do you know other states have worked this out? Are we the first?
I don't know.
No, we're not the first. Tennessee has their own value-added system. Kentucky has a system. Dallas, Texas school systems have a system. There's actually some very innovative work that Western Oregon University in Monmouth has done. And they call that, in their teacher methodology, it's part of their teacher training program where a key component is making sure that there is a responsible link between how well a teacher teaches and how well a student learns within the context of the classroom. They've actually done some very innovative things. They have quite an impressive database now that when they teach new teachers, they're not only talking about what it is they teach and how they teach, but in the choosing of the specific methodology, how effective is that methodology with the specific students that are in the classroom, compared against the specific learning goals and curriculum that the teachers are required to teach.
What did you mean when you said Tennessee and Kentucky have used value added? What is that? What do those words mean?
The Tennessee system is called their Tennessee value added system.
Okay, what's that mean?
They have a quite complex mathematical and statistical system that will predict how much each individual student is to learn given where they have a pretest at the beginning of the classroom and then where they should be coming out at the end of that school year. And they call that their value-added system. So it's a value that's added through teaching of the child in terms of their learning.
Don't you think most kids are tested the first year and the end of the year?
I think that was part of the reason that when we talked about this assessment of the effectiveness of the teacher, that kind of made sense to us because it is broad and we didn't specify what the assessment system is. Most, if not all, teachers have a pretest, in other words, where their students are in terms of knowledge and skills at the beginning of the school year, and then at the end of the school year, how much that they have grown. This concept here would say, well, let's take a look at that and make that as part of the evaluation system to see how effective certain teachers are. And as we identify those that are more effective, you can use those as models and mentors for other teachers to improve their skills. And part of the evaluation process is the professional improvement, a professional development, a continual professional development. That is part, it's not just a evaluation of how well you're doing your job. It's also to look at how you can improve and make yourself a better teacher. So that makes sense in terms of how you can integrate the link between accountability and student performance within a system that looks at the context of the classroom and the individual students in that classroom. And the reason I think that it might be better to have it broader rather than more specific is it allows flexibility between district to district, school to school, but also between classroom and classroom. My wife is a teacher in the Salem-Keizer Structured Learning Center, where she's dealing with students who are gang-related, who have been expelled because of various inappropriate behaviors. Those standards for student growth and achievement may be more related to Senator Starr's comments on character, self-control, those types of issues that may be much more important and will allow them to have subsequent academic achievement, but at this time that's more important, and that's what that has to focus on. So this, the broadness of this language allows that type of flexibility. Does that make sense?
Sort of. But I'm just really, since we decided to put our fingers in this pie and meddle around, I just think in that we should kind of define our terms, I guess. That's what our intent is. But because I don't think it says much to me, student achievement growth. I don't think that we're telling the teachers or the school districts or the people that spend this money that we're supposed to have under our control what we value in achievement.
Part of that is the responsibility of the local school board to identify and define what specific levels of student achievement, how broad, what scope, whether it's what priority character education citizenship skills has with other academic skills. That's the key work of every local school board. What this language does is it says whatever that definition is locally, it should be part of the evaluation system that we have at least some type of an assessment of the effectiveness of teachers and administrators in producing those results.
You get from us that we don't want both character improvement and academic improvement?
I would say yes. Yes.
Would you want to change the word growth, something other than growth, and say academic and character?
That's fine with me, because then a teacher that doesn't embrace the school reform but is still teaching the kids can say, look at this, this is where they were lying, or this is whatever, and look at this is where they're leading. They may not have changed all the values that you want in the school reform, but they have grown academically, and in their defense, they have grown character-wise. I would feel comfortable with that, but I'm only one. Would you feel comfortable?
I think we need a little time to wordsmith that.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
I think that we got to wait still for through the bill, and then we can do some wordsmithing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for allowing me this time, Senator. Okay.
Well, thank you. Assistant Vice Chair. There is no such chair. Anyway, I'd like to go to Section 5, if I might, and just discuss the difference between having the evaluation be primarily, or the structure of the evaluation be established by the administrator versus the school board, because I had the joy of sitting and feeding my child last night while watching on cable access a very exciting meeting of the Portland Public Schools. And personally, I would much prefer to have all of this. I understand the desire for standardization. But on the other hand, in watching the way the school board operates, I would feel so much better having the administrator deal with what do I need in this school to make it operate with this particular population that I have coming into the school. Because I'll tell you, just my two high schools, the difference between Jefferson and Roosevelt is substantial in the kind of population you have around those high schools and who will be attending. And I guarantee you, there is virtually nobody on the Portland Public School Board who has the slightest idea of what is best in either school in terms of the teacher necessary to stimulate the kids and get them to learn. And so it just, the thought of shifting any emphasis or anything from the district superintendent to the school board, I don't know. I personally would feel more comfortable with the district superintendent overseeing that sort of thing.
I can draw your attention to lines 15 and 16 on page 6. It's the district school board shall develop an evaluation process for teachers in consultation with school administrators and with teachers.
Right.
That's the current statute. That process has not been done solely by a school board. It has always been in conjunction with the with administrators and teachers within the school district itself. And if you look up at the change from moving the purpose down to the second paragraph, really doesn't change that dynamic. And the district superintendent sentence on lines 7 and 8 really talks about the district superintendent shall cause to have made at least annually but with multiple observations and evaluation of the probationary teacher. So just by moving the sentence related to the purpose, it doesn't change the structure of the statute in the sense that the district school board is still working in conjunction with administrators and teachers to develop the evaluation process.
So, could I?
Yes.
So Section 5, sub 1 is current statute at this time?
Yes.
And sub 2A is, other than the bold, is current statute?
Correct.
And I guess I'm just wondering what the rationale could have been for the original wording.
I think part of the rationale is that evaluation process has to be based on the job description and performance standards. It becomes the duty of the school board to be able to determine what it is that each of the employee groups within its purview do. In other words, the school board chooses, with the advice and recommendation of the superintendent, what is in the job description and what performance standards they're going to hold their staff accountable to. So in terms of a system, it makes sense to have the school board involved because they are the ultimate authority at the local level.
Okay. I think the fact that the school board is the ultimate authority, we're still going to have the teachers and the principals doing the setting up the program.
Yes, on a very practical level, that's really the only way that it can happen.
Okay. I just think the language is cumbersome and confusing. The way sub 1 is in existing law makes sense. Regardless of who sets up the evaluation, it's the responsibility of the superintendent to see to it that the evaluation is done, and it's very clear in the same section what the reason is for doing the evaluation. And all you've left in sub 1 is that the superintendent is going to see to it that the evaluation is done, and then you move down to sub 2 to go into the school board shall develop an evaluation process, and I think it leaves it, it's just awkward. They're going to set it up. I guess you're supposed to assume that's the same one from sub 1 and that that's the one that the superintendent is going to use. I just think it's very awkward language the way it's done. I mean, if whoever wants developing it, I guess my experiences are somewhat like Senator Wild, but you can have whoever you want developing it. It just seems more straightforward to say that the superintendent is going to be the one who sees to it that this evaluation is done, and the purpose of the evaluation is this. And then if you wanted to go in and say, oh, and by the way, that evaluation is going to be set up by these other folks, then that would make more sense. Okay.
I believe that change really does help clarify in the sense that in both sub 1 and sub 2, we're talking about the school administrators working together with the board and teachers to develop the process. And the purpose of the process then is laid out after you develop the process. So I think very nicely the way they changed it. They didn't change anything except just placement within the section. So I don't see why we can have such a big to-do about it.
So all we did is move it down.
Same order.
Okay. Go ahead.
On page 7, lines 8 through 11, is the next change. And that is to fix something that happened in 1997, which took away some discretion and made more difficult to administer locally in terms of program assistance for improvement. The old statute said a written program assistance for improvement would be established if it's needed to remedy a deficiency. In 1997, we changed the statute so that certain grounds for dismissal do not require a program assistance, but all deficiencies in other grounds do require program assistance for improvement. That was a mistake. There were some grounds that don't require program assistance for improvement, like conviction of a felony and stuff like that. I mean, you're not going to fix that. On the other hand, the A, D, G, and H grounds, which are performance grounds, might not necessarily require program of assistance for improvement. And the administrator in the old statute had the authority to decide that. If you're late, and continually late, you don't have to continue to have a person that doesn't show up for work, but you can take action quickly without a program of assistance. Now, the way we changed it in 1997, it says a written program of assistance for improvement is established if one is needed to remedy any deficiency in any of those subparagraphs. So what they did was they took away the discretion of a building level administrator to say, okay, this is one that you can fix with a program assistance, or this is one that doesn't require it, simply talk to them about it and fix it, or this is one that can't be fixed. So we lost some discretion in terms of administration over this issue. This language, we believe, will return it to the way it was treated prior to 1997, except that it doesn't even mention the program assistance for those other grounds that were taken out, which were physical and mental incapacity, immorality, insubordination, conviction, or felony. So we're trying to sort of restore it where it was before this one of the changes made in Senate Bill 880. Next issue is this one.
Confidentiality.
Okay. In section 6, the only thing changed is the word B in line 27, and we need to explain that to you. It isn't several procedures. It is either the procedure shall be commenced or. And the problem was that V has never been there. And so we thought this was a great opportunity to put the assumed V in the statute. Okay?
That's right.
Okay. Section 7. April 1 date. Let's see. The big issue here is on page 10, lines 6 and 7. Under the statute, you can now non-extend a teacher, because you aren't sure yet whether you're going to give them a contract for the next period, but that non-extension can be a year or 2 years before that action. And a problem that arises is if you're non-extending a teacher under the current statute, and that's in the newspaper, then everybody knows that this personnel action is going on, and it sort of prejudices against that individual. What we're asking here is that this initial decision not to extend be one that's made in executive session to protect the interests of the teacher and the school district while they work out what has to change in order to result in the extension of that contract. This is something I think that teachers and administration should embrace.
I'd like to address this subject because in the open meeting law for our state, part of the idea was that substantive decisions would be done in the open. They would not be done in executive session. Yes, you do need situations where you can sit back and jawbone and then say, okay, why are we doing this? But nevertheless, the initial decision should be done in an open public hearing so that people can have knowledge of it, they can question it, they can be aware of it. And personally, I would just really have an impossible time voting for this with this word.
I think you would have cases, as an example, they brought up a teacher that comes late, and you say not to extend the contract. The correction would be to buy him a run clock, maybe?
That's true, but actually, personally, it wouldn't be bad if the public were aware that that teacher was coming to work.
Right. You knew a teacher was on a time of assistance, and you let your kid go that time?
If it were that they were coming late, and I thought they were a good teacher, I'd probably suggest to them, I think you're a great teacher, but you know what? You might get sacked. You really want to do that just because you can't get to work on time? And you know what? They might tell you about this problem they're having at home. I mean, it helps you get to know the person who's educating your child. And I don't want those decisions made behind closed doors. I just don't. I mean, I might go buy them alarm clock if, in fact, that's the sole reason they aren't showing up. It was the whole idea behind the open meeting law, just so that we as citizens can be involved in what takes place that directly impacts.
Chair, and right, Senator Wilde,
yeah,
the public...
Right, this is completely contrary to the open meetings law. It's the only decision that I know of that would be in the entire set of ORSs that would be allowed in executive session. Personally, I want to know how my school board members are voting. I want to know which ones are voting for sanctions or dismissal or whatever. You can do all the discussing that you want behind closed doors, and when the decision is voted on, it doesn't have to be a motion that you know, Mary Jane is under whatever because she came late or because of this or that. But to terminate a contract is a really serious issue, and I think the public deserves to know how school board members are voting on that.
You know, they still have a long ways to go. When you first decide not to extend the contract, they have a year's standard assistance.
Mm-hmm. But I just...
This is the initial decision only, and I think there's good reasons to protect confidentiality with employees.
I think the confidentiality is protecting a standard school board members.
I don't think
lady.
So.
Before you get too far down this road, I think if you look at the public meetings law, there are authorities to go into executive session, and those authorities are not because something's embarrassing. Those authorities are to protect individuals.
Absolutely right.
And
there's
this,
no decision-making authority.
There is for
personnel reasons.
Well, not for dismissal. Or
for negotiations, but not the decision. The decision you have to go back in.
Expulsion of a student can't be in public, nor can it ever be revealed.
What did you just say?
Expulsion of a student is one of those, for instance, that's been in executive session. Examination of medical records, so to speak, and that's kind of an executive session.
The decision is made in public session.
Yes.
The discussion is in executive session. I'm not objecting to that. Discuss all of this in executive session. But the decision is made in a public meeting.
The purpose of this proposal was to make sure that it wasn't going to be damaging to the individual at this initial decision. And that was the only reason we did this. Eventually, when that person's not, contract is not renewed, that's going to be a known quantity. But in the initial stage, we had a lot of worry about how that impugned a particular individual who was working the system if they knew at that early stage because of the year, more than a year notice that it takes under that statute. And this was intended to protect the teacher, not to protect the school board. That was the purpose. The teacher can go out and tell us if they want. I mean, there's nothing that stops that.
In just a second. I agree with you. The only thing that's for their concern, could we say that the teacher or the employee has a right to know how they voted? If you're going to make the decision in executive session, that they could have, and that way it puts it in the teacher's hand. They can have the minutes or whatever it was. That part of the minutes that dealt with them, if they want to know which school board member. Because you're not doing it to protect the voting of the school board members. I believe that. You're doing it to protect the teacher.
The teacher should know this.
Sure.
This was not the intent that the teacher would not know.
Sure.
What
the vote.
The intent was that it would
sure.
not be on television.
I agree with
you. When he made that decision. I think if you look at the exemptions from disclosure of information under the public meetings law, it's generally protect individual rights. That's what those are. That's what we intended to do.
Well, the initial decision doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad teacher.
That's right.
They just need some help in some more of the truth area. And to put a cloud over that person for the next year, everything would be such a multiple. So that would be nice feeling, right? But if you want it out in the public, then...
I've always been trained to believe that the open meeting clause is an incredibly important law, and that government bodies, all of them, are supposed to follow it. And the exemptions, or the things that you can go into public meeting over, in contracts is one of them, are very clear. I mean, you can discuss everything under the sun. Now, let's face it, if a teacher is late now, somehow they manage to deal with it without having to have it on cable television at night. Like I said, I had a close relationship with those lawyers for 4 years. When you start pulling things out of the public view, the decisions, the actual vote that a public body is making.
I guess I wouldn't object if the final decision is made to not renew that contract. At this particular time, the decision is made not to renew the contract, and now they're going to put them on a year's probation, but they put them on a permanent assistance for a year. And if I were a teacher at that point, I'd say, forget it, I'm gone. If a teacher is able to make the correction and not lose credibility in the school, you'd end up with a good teacher. These things are not really contracts. They're not incorruptible. I guess I feel that you ought to give the person a chance to correct it if this particular thing is without public notice of that. That's how I feel about it. If you don't want to leave it in, then we should take it out.
So it hasn't been working for the last 3 or 4 years?
Well, I think that's the reason it's suggested that we put in, because there have been some people that when they're notified that the contract may not be extended, it's an embarrassing position, I think, for us. It's to protect the individual, not the system.
Mr. Chair, I think on page 38 you talk about the amendment to, I think this is the open records law. What's exempt is the decision to extend or not extend or dismiss a contract teacher pursuant to 342.895 or materials or documents supporting that action unless the contract teacher gives permission for the disclosure. So what we're trying to do there is say, as the employer in taking this action and talking about deficiencies of your performance, Mr. Individual, we are not going to release that publicly at this point in time unless you release it. And that's what it's designed to do, to protect the individual. That's on page 38 in section 16 of the bill. And I think that's a public records change. I think there's also a public public meetings change on page 34. No, that might be public records as well. But the purpose here was to allow as one of the exemptions from full disclosure at a particular time or a non-extension of the contract to not make that public. You don't embarrass the individual. You have time to make the correction. You have time to extend the contract. That was the purpose. It was not to try to sneak around.
Time, it goes. That's an exemption from public records. We do that from time to time to try to protect people. That's not a decision of a publicly elected body. Whatever. I'm not going to win any of these, so there's no sense in going on it. You know, there's no, I'm not going to win on any of these, so there's no sense in going on and on about them.
Well, may I just want to say, on this one, on page 10, I think it's prudent. It's a good idea.
Next issue. Where are we, Ron?
Page 11.
Page 11. You want to explain this one?
This amendment proposes deletion of some language on page 11, lines 14 through 16. This is a part of the fair dismissal statute that talks about an alternative to the fair dismissal process in the case of agreement arbitration over related issues of evaluation or some type of fundamental unfairness in a program of assistance or approval. This particular section talks about if a teacher is appeals a dismissal and they go to the fair dismissal appeals panel, and then they also have some other type of contractual grievance that they want to pursue. But the statute says that in the cases that a fair dismissal decision to dismiss a teacher is upheld by the fair dismissal panel, and then we have another type of contract grievance on related to evaluation or the PAI itself, the arbitrator doesn't have the power to reinstate the employee over the fair dismissal approval of the appeal. What this language also added in 1997 is that the arbitrator may not have the authority to reinstate, but the arbitrator could have other types of remedies, including front pay, compensatory damage, or such further relief as the arbitrator deems appropriate. This is an extraordinary allocation of authority to an arbitrator. I don't know personally of any arbitrator in the United States that had the ability to defund pay and compensatory damages. Those are usually reserved for a court of law. In addition, given the fact that the dismissal has been already upheld by the fair dismissal panel, why would we want to then have front pay and compensatory damages? So this amendment suggests that we limit that to the back pay issues only.
Okay. I should probably preface my remarks by saying I'm not feeling well today anyway, which may have left me a little bit grumpy, but is this language that was negotiated in 95 or 97?
97.
Why did you negotiate it this way then?
I did not do the negotiation, so I can express an opinion on it, but I can't give you a factual.
It appears to me that we're cleaning up things we didn't get in 95 and 97. And maybe that's a negative way of looking at it, but that's what it appears to me to be. And did you give concessions then and somebody and then don't like the concessions now, or it struck me as strange. There's no other arbitrator anywhere around who can give these kinds of things. Isn't that sort of like there's no other public body that can make a decision in a closed meeting? But that one was okay and this one isn't?
It just seems like it ought to be a better reason. Even if what you want to say is, we don't want to pay him the money. To me, that's better than saying, well, no other arbitrator has this kind of authority, but we negotiated it a couple of years ago, and now it didn't sound so good.
Well, frankly, I didn't think it sounded so good then either.
Oh. Well, somebody did.
Yes, apparently somebody did.
And didn't have 16 or 31 votes. But this was something we truly gave too much. You're right. I'm trying to correct the mistake. There's no question about it. The next issue is the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board process. What we did in 880 was we tried to have a hearings officer do the hearing and then bring the hearing results to the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board panels. And the panels did not like that. They wanted to actually hear the evidence. We thought it would speed it up, and it won't speed it up. The complexities of the timing have to do with three lay people on a three-person tripartite board plus the attorney's schedules. And so the process we thought would speed it up last time not only didn't speed it up, but the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board panels would rather hear the case directly. And so we're going back to the process. Again, a mistake in 80. We're going to the process that was in effect for FDAB panels prior to the Senate Bill 880 changes. However, there is another process that you can choose to use locally, which is to go to an arbitrator rather than the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board. And that arbitrator is the rule under precedent and case law of the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board, and it's a discretion. And we're proposing that rather than the 10-person panel that was to be agreed upon of individuals, that we go to the administrative law judges that are being created, the professional administrative law judges that are being created, as the mechanism to hold those hearings, make those recommended findings of fact and recommended orders. Is that right?
That's right.
And then it takes a lot of stuff out that we put in last time that tried to enforce timelines that aren't enforceable. They just don't fit. And that's Section 8.
Section 10 is the actual process for the use of an administrative law judge as an arbitrator.
And that starts on page 18. Section 11 on page 20 is a substitute change. This takes out the subsection of law that says, regardless of all of the rest of that, a school district and exclusive bargaining rep can waive all or part of those rights as long as a third-party review of a dismissal or non-extension process. And basically, our approach here is to say there ought to be a standard for the processes that are used for non-extension or non-renewal of contract teachers, and that ought to be something that's outlined in the statute, and the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board case law is the one that's developed over a number of years to do that. And so rather than build a willy-nilly process of different procedures across the state, we've got to stick with that process.
And, is this an attempt to get the bargaining unit out of it?
This is an attempt to not bargain locally, plateau bargain locally with this statutory protection, additional protections for termination. And it goes, it's also in section 14 that says the court process is in criteria. This is page 26. The process is in criteria for dismissal or contract non-extension of contract teachers and dismissal of non-renewal probationary teachers are not included in the definition of employment relations, but permissive and non-mandatory subjects of bargaining. So what we've done is simply add to the list of those issues that you can't compel a strike over, like you did in Turner Ridge, or the process and criteria for dismissal or contract extension of contract teachers, or dismissal of non-renewal probationary teachers. So the issue is, does the state of Oregon have a process they think is fair and adequate? And should school districts locally be whipsawed by bargaining units to add additional, more protection? And this change would make that a permissive subject for bargaining. And this is over, this isn't over discipline, this is over discharge.
So this would be only over dismissal issues, so other standards, for instance, a just cause standard of disciplinary actions leading up to dismissal could still be bargained in the contract.
On page 20, sub 2 in section 11, you said you thought that should be handled in statute. Are you putting that in statute someplace? Or is ORS 342?
I'm sorry, I don't think I understood the question.
The language is being removed on page 20, section 11, sub 2, mm-hmm. The school district and an exclusive bargaining representative. You said in removing that you thought it shouldn't be bargained, it should be in statute. Is it in statute someplace?
The processes are the ones we talked about, the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board or the arbitration as an alternative.
Okay.
That's what I meant. And that with those two are specified outlines and the criteria to be used are outlined through both the grounds in the statute and the case law that's developed. And this sub 2 simply says, regardless of all that, you can do something else, as long as it has third-party review. And we are suggesting that's not a good idea.
Okay, so that will be that one. And then also, issues of dismissal would not be negotiable.
Okay. Would not be mandatory.
Could still be negotiated? Well, it wouldn't be if they weren't mandatory. I assume that the school board would always say no.
This is subject to bargaining, could be discussed and placed in a collective bargaining agreement. What would be prevented only by a designation and permissive is that you could not strike over that issue.
Okay.
The previous version.
This would be likely to happen only if you had a school board that didn't know what their rights were?
It could happen under that possibility.
Part of
the question that I think this amendment is asking is, what is public policy related to dismissal processes for teachers? Should it be the statutory process or something different?
Sure.
I mean, that's the essential question.
That's the page 20 question.
That's the page 20 and the page 26 question. The original bill made the dismissal process as a prohibited subject to bargaining, saying it could not appear in a collective bargaining agreement. So this is a little bit more of a movement towards the collective bargaining and, frankly, somewhat of a compromise here.
Do you see a school board in the state of Oregon who, knowing they didn't have to negotiate on it, would?
Yes.
Really? Oh, yeah. As long as they knew the teachers couldn't strike over it.
That changes except for the language that's added to deal with the public records law, I believe, in the public meetings law, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Public records.
Okay.
Okay, any other questions for these two gentlemen? Good. Well, thank you very much, and I'm sure you will have to stand by for questions as we get into the process.
Yep.
Thank you, Archer. Nito, William.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today and continue providing input and for the opportunity to be a part of the dialogue with respect to Senate Bill 1180. My name is Mark Toledo. I'm the General Counsel for the Oregon Education Association. I'm here to testify on behalf of the association. I have provided written testimony for the committee, and I will not go through and read that, but perhaps in the interest of time, I could go through and comment on some of the issues and questions that were raised during the testimony by the Oregon School Board Association. The first thing I would like to say is to try to give a global response from the association with respect to Senate Bill 1180. This bill rehashes much of what was debated and discussed in 1997 in what began as Senate Bill 650 and ended up as Senate Bill 880, which contained a major overhaul of the fair dismissal statute. From a short historical view, that statute has been in effect less than 2 years, and only one dismissal case has gone all the way through that procedure during that time. There have been many other dismissal cases or dismissals in school districts throughout the state that were settled or the teacher did not appeal their dismissal. And that is consistent with the 23 or 5 year history of the Fair Dismissal Appeal Law. So at this time, we've only had the opportunity to see one case go through that process and start to learn how the Senate Bill 880 amendments affect the process. I would submit to the committee that the considerable changes now being proposed by the Oregon School Board Association are too early and too many. I'd also submit that those changes came about after a lot of work, a lot of compromise on the part of many parties, the Oregon Education Association, the Oregon School Board Association, and the Organization of School Administrators. Many of the changes here were ones that were discussed then. For example, programs of assistance, evaluations, procedures for the appeal of a fair dismissal case. Those are all things that were overhauled in 1997, and we believe do not need to be overhauled now, although there are some housekeeping things that we think would improve the law. With that, I'd like to go through and comment on a number of the issues that you had questions about and that Mr. Dudley and Mr. Wilson testified to on behalf of the Oregon School Board Association. The first thing I want to comment about is the area of programs of assistance for improvement. These changes or clarifications, as they would call them, I think are unnecessary. As a general matter, school districts can implement a program of assistance for improvement for probationary teachers and contract teachers. The statute expressly allows for that, and there are not limitations on school districts who wish to implement a program of assistance for improvement. Mr. Dudley spoke to the need for specific clarification at page 2 in paragraph 6. 6A, saying that that clarifies the statute, but is unnecessary because a program of assistance for improvement states that it means a written plan for a contracted teacher. Under that part of the statute, it states that it's for a contract teacher. Mr. Dudley's concerns are unfounded, and it's unnecessary to make that change or clarification unless they have some other intent. I indicated that under the current statute, it's ORS 342.895, subparagraph 4P, 4B, language is written into that to expressly provide that a superintendent or his or her designated school principal can place any other teacher on a program of assistance for improvement if in their judgment they find it necessary to do so. So school administrators are not limited in use of that, and the statute indicates by the changes in 1997 when they have to do it. If a teacher is not extended, if a contract teacher is not extended, they have to be placed on a program of assistance for improvement. It doesn't state how long or how extensive that may be, and we submit that that is something that a local school board or their administrators ought to decide. They have the ability to do so, and they're the ones who evaluate the teachers, and I think for those of you who have some experience in schools, a program of assistance for improvement can be something that lasts as short as 2 weeks or something that lasts as long as a year. It's not as complex and complicated as some believe it is. The next thing I want to talk about is Section 2, where the OSDA's proposed amendment that would change the definition of a temporary teacher. This is on page 3, line 15 through line 19. This is a significant change. The Oregon Education Association strongly opposes this change. The reason we oppose this change is because historically, temporary teachers or the position of temporary teacher involved a position that came up because of the unannounced resignation or the surprise dismissal or the death or disability of a teacher. By changing the date to August 1 rather than it being after the opening of the school year, that will mean that many teachers lose rights that they have under existing collective bargaining agreements. All collective bargaining agreements have a recognition clause that indicates who gets the rights of the collective bargaining agreement. And many collective bargaining agreements do not extend the rights of the contract to temporary teachers. So if the date that somebody can be designated a temporary teacher, somebody who's hired after August 1st, that's going to create, I would say, hundreds of new temporary teachers who will be excluded from the rights of a contract that exists for temporary teachers now. This is a significant change. I don't know that much was said about it, but I wanted to bring it to your attention.
Yes, Mayor, a question. You're saying that's already been negotiated, that what you just said?
I say, yes, contracts on the state identify who is covered by the contract, and frequently temporary teachers are not included in the contract. And this date, this is changing the definition of a contract teacher to someone who is hired as of August 1 or later, will create many new temporary teachers, because many teachers are not hired until after August 1. And if they are a temporary teacher, they will not have the rights under the contract that other teachers have.
But would it be your interpretation that every teacher hired after one would be temporary, even if they had a contract?
Yes. If that was when they were first hired in the district, they would then become a temporary teacher.
Okay.
It does seem to say that, but even if they taught all year long?
Even if they taught all year long under this change, under this change, they would be a temporary teacher. I also want to comment on the language dealing with the change in the evaluation part of the statute to add language that requires assessment based upon the individual or on how a teacher or the effectiveness of a teacher in producing individual students achievement growth. The association opposes this change for a number of the reasons that have already been raised by one or two members of the committee. I would like to add that at the April, I think, 27th or 28th hearing on Senate Bill 1180, there was extensive testimony in opposition to this provision, and I would like to incorporate the testimony of Senator Bryant's wife, who spoke eloquently as to why this provision is not a good idea. You have already recognized, and Senator Shannon recognized, some of the reasons why it is not a good idea. And there are, I want to say that the current evaluation process that exists in school districts provides a broad framework for school districts to evaluate and assess the performance of teachers, including how well teachers are performing in the area of student growth and progress. The last dismissal case that I took to the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board involved just such a case. And the school district did not need this statutory language to deal with an area where this particular teacher was being criticized for how well she was providing students and inspiring students to individual growth and achievement. We have great concerns about how this amendment may be misused and believe that it is unnecessary because school districts already have a broad framework for evaluating teachers. I would agree with Mr. Dudley that local communities are greatly concerned about education and how successful public education is. And I think there are great successes in public education around the state, and it is because of that commitment Mr. Dudley identifies. For that reason, I think those local communities who are responsible for delivering the service of public education are the ones that ought to have the discretion to deal with this issue and evaluation. Next, I want to comment on the on another clarification on page 7 dealing with programs of assistance. Mr. Dudley spoke to it in lines 6 through 10 and feel that school boards have some limitation because of the limiting these programs of assistance for improvement to these particular sections of the statute, A, D, G, or H. Those four sections of the statute deal with four of the nine reasons for which a teacher can be dismissed, or for which a contract teacher can be dismissed. A is inefficiency, D is neglect of duty, G is inadequate performance, and H is failure to comply with reasonable requirements as a board may prescribe to show improvement. The reason the statute limits, in this case, programs of assistance for improvement through these areas is because for all intents and purposes, those are the performance areas where a program of assistance can be of help. I think Mr. Dudley conceded that some of the other statutory reasons, immorality, conviction of a felony, physical or mental disability, are ones where a program of assistance is not going to be effective, is unnecessary. Next area I want to discuss is that area that deals with the issue of making decisions involving the extension or non-extension of teachers in executive session. The OEA agrees with that proposal because, with all respect for the public meetings law, that is a typical type personnel decision that currently is something discussed in executive session today. It is not a final decision involving a school teacher, and we believe it assists both the teacher and the public body to be able to make that evaluation decision in an executive session. The next area I want to talk about is the changes that the OSBA proposes through these amendments involving the arbitrator's authority to award front pay and compensatory damages. In the first instance, I want to say that arbitrators already have authority to award front pay and compensatory damages. There are case decisions where arbitrators have done that. it would be less so of compensatory damages, but there are case decisions where arbitrators have done that. I think this is this part of what was Senate Bill 880 came about as a result of a compromise where teachers could make the choice of giving up the right to reinstatement. And in many dismissal cases, a school district wants to not have the option of reinstatement before a teacher, so school districts like that option. Again, the quid pro quo for giving up the right to reinstatement was to expressly state that an arbitrator in that type of case could award front pay or compensatory damages. And that arbitration would only be over whether or not a plan of assistance or dismissal was fundamentally unfair. I have to tell you, in terms of legal standards, it's a high standard to meet. This right of an arbitrator to do this creates a safety net to provide a meaningful remedy for somebody who is dismissed after being subjected to a plan of assistance that is fundamentally unfair. I think most school districts are not going to do something like that, but there are always the exceptions. The next thing I want to address is the proposed changes to dump the hearing officer process we have right now and return to the fair dismissal appeals board process. I think during the time that we were working with the legislature and the debate about 880 was going on, we had strong reservations about changing the process in this fashion. But now that we have it, I think there are housekeeping things that could make this process better. For example, allowing the current hearing officers already incorporated in the law to make findings of fact and conclusions of law that could then be appealed to the Court of Appeals. That would, I think, streamline the administrative process considerably. The parties had already agreed to 10 people that we believe that the OSDA, OEA, and COSA all felt were qualified to hear these types of cases. Again, after just having lived with this new law for less than 2 years, having only one case go all the way through the hearing process of debate, we think it's unwise to flip-flop on major legislation that governs 35,000 teachers, well, not 35,000 because they're not all contract teachers, but a substantial number of teachers in the state. We believe that improvements could be made to the process, and we're open to working with the parties involved to do that, but I think the suggestions being made by OSCA here are not the right way to go. They have also proposed changes to allow for a hearing officer process involving hearing officers appointed by the employment department. I submit that the employment department, with all due respect to their hearing officers, is not an agency that's had experience with dismissal cases. They've had experience with unemployment insurance claims, unemployment insurance cases, and unemployment insurance appeals. This will be a disservice to the educational community to send these types of hearings to an agency that doesn't have that experience. The Fair Dismissal Appeals Board does. The hearing officers that the parties agreed to last time have this type of experience, and they can handle these cases aptly. The next area I'd like to address involves Section 14. This involves a major and critical elimination of collective bargaining rights for teachers. It would make the right to bargain over the criteria for dismissal of teachers a permissive subject to bargaining. Senator Duke has identified, I think, through her question of the OSCA representative, that this is something that they would never have to bargain if it becomes a permissive subject of bargaining. I can tell you that the Oregon Education Association also represents classified employees, educational support personnel in school districts, and the ones they represent, and I believe ones represented by OSEA and others all have the right to bargain over criteria for dismissal. I would say probably all of the classified employees that the OEA represents have bargained for just cause. That's a common job security issue, one of the most important job security issues that unions bargain over, not just in the educational community, but throughout the state. And we strongly oppose this change to the collective bargaining law that would take away rights, substantial rights of the association. I should also suggest that as a practical matter, this is another local community issue, and I submit that local communities who bargain these contracts should be credited with the wisdom and the decision-making authority to decide whether they want to bargain these issues or not. Again, I'd like to close by saying that many of these issues were raised 2 years ago or 4 years ago by changes made by Senate Bill 750 and by changes made by Senate Bill 880, and we think it's unnecessary now to go back and rehash them once again. I think it is inappropriate to go back and undo some of the compromises that were reached in 1997. Again, we are there to work with the interested parties where changes would be helpful, and there are some, as I've indicated in my written testimony. Again, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the association.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you. Anyone else wants to get
that? I'm Maryland teacher. I don't know if there is one here, though. What? You were asking earlier if any teachers were going to testify. I'm not sure if we had this here earlier.
I think they were represented.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Nice to know that there is one in the room.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask, so on this bill,
we closed the public hearing at 11:80.
I would like to ask unanimous consent that I be allowed to vote on HB 2419.
Okay, is there any objections? And then go ahead. You vote?
Vote aye.
Okay. You want to vote on the other one too, 3607?
Yeah, I'll vote aye. Oh. Do I have to request that?
Okay. Is there, is this the last floor or
Yes,
yeah, I make a statement. I'd like to thank the Oregon School Board Association for the excellent testimony and bringing this bill forward. Thank you.
Okay.
Very well. Never mind. You want to vote on the You also voted on
3-6. Thank you. Okay. And we will adjourn the committee.
Have you turned this off?